From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi watched the foreign press flock to his country to cover one of the big stories this week. Leaders of the Catholic Church gathered in Rome to lay out a policy for disciplining priests charged with sexual abuse. The conservative leader didn't seem to mind the presence of so many foreign journalists for a few days. It's the local media he seems bent on dominating. Berlusconi's latest targets are two Italian journalists and a satirist who have criticized him on TV in the past. "Away with them," Berlusconi said recently. "They have made criminal use of public television." These are no idle threats when you consider Berlusconi's status. Aside from owning three of the four private national stations, as prime minister, Berlusconi officially controls all three state-run networks in Italy, cumulatively known as RAI. And with recent appointments of his friends to high positions at two of those public networks, Italian TV is looking more Berlusconi-esque than ever. Joining us from Rome is NPR senior European correspondent Silvia Pajoli. Silvia, welcome to OTM.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, it appears that this latest outrage has, at long last, gotten the Italian public up in arms. They were a little late to be distressed by Berlusconi's behavior, or am I missing something?
Well, you know, let's remember something, that Berlusconi won by only 500,000 votes, but thanks to the Italian electoral law, kind of winner takes all, he has a very comfortable majority in Parliament. So to say that he actually has, you know, a huge mandate from the people, from the voters, is not really correct. And in past months, there have been a lot of demonstrations, mainly organized by intellectuals, professors, and so forth, protesting his conflict of interest, the extent of his power over the media. So there's beginning to be a little of a groundswell. The fact is, though, that he does have a very comfortable majority in Parliament, and therefore a lot of political influence.
Berlusconi's gotten quite a bit of criticism lately for appointing political cronies to run the state television networks that he didn't previously control. Is there anybody maintaining that these guys are not strictly following his orders to suppress legitimate dissent?
The fact is that the state-run television system, the board of directors and the heads of the news art have always been assigned according to a political spoil system. Whatever party is in government, is running the government, has its people running the news show. Yes, there's definitely been a shift towards the right. Berlusconi gets, it's been estimated, 5 to 7 times more coverage on the state-run TVs now than the opposition does. You certainly see a difference in the slant of the evening news. But I mean, the thing, it's subtle. Criticism by some European government or some European leader who may have some remark to say, it comes in late in the newscast. It's not heavy-handed censorship, let's call it that. It's a slant. It's a presentation. It's the way the whole thing is packaged. But it's the system that hasn't been changed since the end of the Second World War.
And most recently, in the center of this uproar, he issued more than a veiled threat that dissenting voices on state television should simply be fired. And when challenged on that, he said, well, no, they don't have to be fired as long as they change their ways. Has he apologized or backed off of that statement at all?
Oh, not at all. However, there has been some side effects. It was so outrageous that at least the two journalists, their jobs are probably actually safe now, because what Berlusconi said was so outrageous that it would be too embarrassing now to fire them.
I have spent countless hours watching RAI in various hotel rooms of the world. It's the worst television network I have seen anywhere in the world, and I've seen lots of them. It's unwatchable. How could it have any influence at all?
Well, have you seen Berlusconi's TV networks? That's the all these silly entertainment shows, all these scantily clad women. Well, this is the style that Berlusconi's networks introduced into Italy. Rai just felt it had to compete and adapted much of that style. But there are occasionally some documentaries and some more serious news programs which are not so bad, which you don't see on Mediaset, which is the company that runs the three Berlusconi commercial TV networks.
So if there is some sort of spontaneous uprising at long last against Berlusconi for his very heavy-handed tactics in suppressing dissent, how would the Italian public ever find out about it?
Well, there still are some newspapers that are independent now. I mean, it's not a closed society. It's not that bad.
Well, Sylvia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sylvia Pagioli is the senior European correspondent for NPR, and she spoke to us from Rome.
Amidst all the coverage of the Middle East in recent weeks, you may have heard about the book called Revenge. It's an account written by Washington Post reporter Laura Blumenfeld of her quest to confront the Palestinian militant who shot her father. Her father was injured, but he recovered. Blumenfeld did not. She decided at some personal risk to pursue the shooter, exact some kind of revenge, and write about it all. But throughout, she confronts an ethical dilemma. She cannot say who she is or why she is there. She works her way into the good graces of the shooter's family, the Khattab family, as a book writer, interested in the shooter as a symbol, but with no personal stake in the case. She lies. As a human being, she struggles with that, but as a journalist, she doesn't. And we wondered, should she have?
Journalists are supposed to deal in the truth, and they're supposed to present the truth and quest for the truth.
Josh Hammer is the Jerusalem bureau chief for Newsweek.
I think when you're dealing with the issues of deception like this, you have to really weigh the ethical questions against the end result. I keep thinking of this book, the classic book, the old book from the 60s, Black Like Me, where this white journalist went undercover as a black man and really came up with a very compelling narrative. I mean, that was a clear deception, and it worked. I don't think we condemn the writer for fooling those around him by posing as a black man.
That landmark work by John Howard Griffin profoundly deepened his white readers' understanding of what it's like to be black in America. Keith Woods, a specialist in journalistic ethics with the Poynter Institute, says that sometimes it's necessary to lie, but a reporter must be seeking something extraordinary.
When you are trying to protect the public from great harm, inform the public about great danger, and all other means of getting that information have failed. So the bar is fairly high, and certainly to demonstrate some measure of revenge doesn't fall into either of those categories.
Ultimately, Blumenfeld's revenge turns out to be an apology. Omar Khattab writes to her from prison that he regrets his action. They come to understand each other. Later, she even tries to win his release. Her book is a tale of reconciliation and of hope. Is that worth a lie? Josh Hammer.
I still, in the back of my mind, I sort of feel that there was an exploitative quality about this and that it really was sort of, she was using these people, clearly using these people. So that bothers me.
It bothered Blumenfeld. She quotes her father, a rabbi, who reminds her that it says, "Don't steal" twice in the holy books. So, he asks, why does it say it twice? Because you're not supposed to steal objects and you're not supposed to steal a person's mind. At some point, you have to be honest. There's a point where you have to have a sense of decency. Blumenfeld writes that her neck felt warm, a rising pang of guilt. When we called her, she said she was willing to discuss the guilt she felt as a person, but she was unwilling and unprepared to answer questions about compromises she made as a journalist. Ethicist Keith Woods.
I understand the motive, I understand the goal, all of those things I have great sympathy for. But I think that you cannot divorce what she's done from the consequences, however remote the possibilities might be, for the safety of journalists here and abroad. Certainly we can look at what happened with Danny Pearl, and if we believe at any level the people who killed him, then we might believe that at some point they thought he was operating as something other than an objective journalist.
But to Josh Hammer, the notion that Blumenfeld's deception increased the danger to reporters in the region is, in his word, far-fetched.
I work in the West Bank in Gaza every day of my life, and it never crossed my mind that maybe my life would be at any more risk because this journalist engaged in deception.
I think her situation was so unique, so sui generis, that it would really be intellectually dishonest to try to draw broader implications for journalism about it.
Samuel Friedman teaches at the School of Journalism at Columbia University. He says that since Blumenfeld was writing a book at the time, on leave from the Washington Post, she wasn't bound by the same rules reporters are. Book writers, he says, are free agents. And he likens her case more to Cyrano de Bergerac's than Woodward and Bernstein's. When Cyrano courted Roxanne, he did it through a front, because otherwise, he believed, he never would be heard.
In a way, Laura Blumenfeld is both Cyrano and Cyrano's front, because by presenting a front that's Laura Blumenfeld writing a book about revenge, she's able to say some of the things that Laura Blumenfeld, the daughter of someone who was nearly killed by a Palestinian militant, would not have been able to say without getting the door slammed in her face on day one.
I'm torn about it. I'm torn. I'm ambivalent. I condemn her act of deception. On the other hand, I accept that this was a valid quest and a need for her to do this.
Reporter Josh Hammer says Blumenfeld's offense is more misdemeanor than grand larceny. And the sentence, even as she reaps the success of her work, will be the one she imposes upon herself.
Maybe the price of her game of deception is this queasiness and this feeling of guilt and this feeling of using people that she probably will always have. When she rereads her book and talks about it, she's always going to be nagged by that feeling, and maybe that's justice.
Blumenfeld seems to have understood that from the start. She wrote, "The journalist in me saw this as an opportunity for discovery. Reporting a book about revenge was an intellectual challenge, an exercise in empathy. The other person, the avenging child, knew that what was coming would be hard. I would lose all distance from my subject. Worse, I would become my subject. The outcome was unclear, the effort self-absorbed, the process full of ethical compromise. When I pictured telling anyone, I cringed."
Coming up, why the CBC won't pardon their French, and two gadfly newspaper critics become newspaper editors.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mike Pesca.
Brooke, why don't you deal with this?
Very well. Every so often, our producer at large, Mike Pesca, joins us in a segment called Mike's Pockets to disgorge the little bits of media fluff that have lodged there. Now, normally this isn't the type of program that exchanges interviews for plugs, but Mike, I understand there's a new project that you're working on right now.
That's right, Brooke. I'm here plugging Neulasta, the new wonder drug from Amgen, Inc. Fight the effects of febrile neutropenia with Neulasta.
You lost me at Neulasta.
Okay, that was just a dramatization of what you might see coming out of the mouth of actor Rob Lowe. He's been hired by Amgen to be a celebrity spokesman for this new drug, Neulasta, and he's getting himself booked on Entertainment Tonight and the Rosie O'Donnell Show, not to plug a new movie or The West Wing, but to plug this new drug.
Does he have to list all the disclaimers?
It's a good question. The FDA says that if he mentions the drug by name rather than just speaking generally about the condition, he has to give out a 1-800 number and list all the side effects, which would have been a good rule if it were in place when he was doing the rounds for St. Elmo's Fire.
So what's new here? This is part of a continuing trend. Drugs are aggressively advertising, and diseases rely more and more on celebrities to draw attention to them. And so what you've gotten now, I guess, is a kind of icky marriage of celebrities endorsing prescription drugs. I mean, celebrities have been testifying on the Hill for quite a while for certain diseases. Michael J. Fox and Christopher Reeve go up there, and they could attract a whole lot more attention than any expert on paralysis or Parkinson's disease ever could.
Right, and this wasn't testimony, but the actress Angie Harmon recently appeared on Capitol Hill endorsing an anti-peeping Tom bill.
Because she was peeped?
Actually, because she played a character who was peeped. So I guess to viewers of that Lifetime special, she was peeped. But this week, celebrity testimony was taken to a new extreme. Listen to this.
When you're learning a song, you can actually read the words to a song, too. So that means you're learning to read also.
I got it. Former Deputy Treasury Secretary Stuart Eisenstadt.
Try again.
Elmo loves music because Elmo gets to dance and Elmo gets to sing.
Yeah, that's Elmo Goes to Washington.
That's right. Elmo the Muppet. Congress took testimony from a fictional character, a fuzzy red sock being manipulated by a guy sitting under the table, and I'm just guessing Enron money.
So what was he testifying about?
He was a spokesman for, oh, did you know this, by the way? Elmo is a spokesman for a trade group. It's the rubber and vulcanized metal manufacturers.
Really?
No, I made that part up. I don't think there's such a thing as vulcanized metal, actually. But why should I be truthful when Congress, U.S. officials, are questioning puppets? He's actually a spokesman, that part's true, for NAMM, which for some reason stands for the International Music Products Association. He wants Congress to allot $2 million for music education, which is a good cause. Yeah, 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 they heard from a puppet. What did the Cookie Monster know, and when did he know it? Okay, so there were only two representatives in the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Labor, Health and Human Services, and Education that day. Duke Cunningham of California seemed to be pulling the strings, if you will. He read questions from a script, who's the puppet there? And then the subcommittee chairman, Ralph Regula, was also there. I just hope before they consider NASA funding, they hear from Yoda.
I can't believe they settled the debate on Arctic drilling without first hearing from Chili Willy and Tennessee Tuxedo.
Yes, a little right flipper, left flipper balance.
Thank you very much, Mike.
At long last, Mr. Snuffleupagus, have you no sense of decency?
On the Media's producer,
well, Miss Piggy, I'm not sure you fully grasp the issue of hog subsidies.
On the Media's producer at large.
Thank you for your testimony here today, Mr. Snagglepuss. Please exit. Stand right.
And so will On the Media's producer at large, Mike Pesca.
Now to our neighbors to the north. A labor dispute has disrupted the broadcasts of Radio Canada, the French language division of the Canadian Broadcasting Company. On March 23rd, employees of the public TV and radio stations staged a 24-hour strike, only to find themselves locked out the following day by CBC management. The lockout, which may last well into the summer, has left Radio Canada's audiences with no new television shows and no news programs. For French Canadians, who make up a quarter of Canada's population, it's just one more battle in the never-ending war against Anglophonic cultural hegemony. Radio Canada's David Gutnick has just come in from the picket lines, and he joins us now from the union offices in Montreal. David, welcome to On the Media.
Hello.
Is Radio Canada the only francophone service for news and entertainment in broadcast? Are there no commercial stations that provide this material?
There are all sorts of commercial stations providing services, but in French Canada, Radio-Canada has a very important role here. The news is much more serious, much more in-depth. It's the place where you'll go to actually get a documentary, for example, on something happening around the world, whereas the commercial broadcasters They don't have the money to do that kind of thing. They don't have journalists overseas. So it's basically your rock and roll station. Now, they've taken advantage of the lockout, and they're beefing up their news presentations, hoping to draw off the audience.
All right. Now, why don't you summarize for me the labor situation? As I understand it, there are three main points. One is the union wants just more money.
That's right.
Secondly, women are markedly underpaid relative to their male counterparts by 14%, according to the statistic that the union is citing. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, workers there are working sometimes for 10 years under year-to-year temporary contracts instead of becoming full-time hires. Is that basically the situation?
Traditionally, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation negotiates with the English-Canadian unions differently than it has negotiated with the French-Canadian unions, and that's just meant that there's French-Canadian unions have not negotiated as well. So here in Quebec, we are paid of less than they are in English Canada. So one of the things we've asked for is to be paid equally to English Canada. So we've been walking the picket line in front of that building in downtown Montreal.
And the consequence is there are 1,400 workers, give or take, who are not producing the news, not reading the news, or, for that matter, entertainment programming as well.
Absolutely. Now, and all sorts of news has happened, of course. You look at the Middle East. Imagine a news show where you're just getting clip after clip after clip of news from around the world, and there's no one explaining what's going on. As for radio, it's basically just music all day long with managers reading little bits of news. So there's basically no journalism happening at all.
This happens at an interesting moment of time, this lockout, because we've been reading that Parti Québécois and French separatism is losing steam. What has the public reaction among Francophones been to the lockout? And has there been a lot of noise, or has the silence been greeted with more silence?
There's been some silence. You're absolutely right. It's sort of surprising. You sort of expect the public to stand up and say, we want our documentaries. We want our round tables. So that's always a little disheartening. You know, Quebec is only a story. What happens in this province is only a story for the rest of Canada when it's about splitting the country up. But when it's actually about preserving culture, and it's actually about making sure that you can turn on your radio and hear that there are actually intellectuals sitting around talking about important issues about Quebec and the world, then it doesn't matter. So if right now we were in the middle of a battle about whether or not Quebec should stay in Canada, you could bet that this would not have been a lockout, that we would have been in there covering it, because the rest of Canada would have wanted to hear every single word.
There's one more thing I just have to ask you.
Mm.
The National Hockey League playoffs are going on right now. Montreal is in them, playing Boston. Was the game televised by Radio Canada?
You can bet it was televised, because the camera people who were making sure that people can see the images are there, and the managers who push the buttons are there, but none of the commentators. So when you turn on your television, what you see is pure hockey, and you can hear the players swearing, and you hear the sound of the puck.
So how is that?
Well, you know, God, I hope none of my union colleagues get angry at me for saying this, but you know what? It's not bad.
David Gutnick is a reporter and host on CBC Radio Canada. That was sound from Wednesday night's Canadians-Bruins playoff game as broadcast on announcerless, locked-out Radio Canada.
Approximately 1.1 million people read the New York Times. It's safe to say that most of those readers don't buy the paper expecting to be driven insane by its style and coverage. Of those who do, the vast majority do not faithfully read through each and every story, combing the paper for errors. And of those few vigilant readers, only one faithfully chronicles the distortions, mistruths, and spelling errors every day on a website. Or at least one did. Ira Stoll, the founder and editor-in-chief of SmarterTimes.com, was the Times' criticizer-in-chief until recently, when he became the managing editor and founder of an actual New York daily newspaper all his own, the New York Sun. Ira, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks.
Now, we should point out that the Smarter Times was really just a hobby, an incredibly time-consuming hobby. But you are a journalist in your own right. You were an editor at The Forward, a legendary Jewish newspaper. So was your complaint at the Times mostly their ideology or their style?
Ideology, style, and just factual inaccuracies. I think, actually, by the way, that the Times is a pretty good newspaper. The New York Sun, my new newspaper, makes mistakes too. The idea is that by having another voice that's not part of the Times, it gives Times readers a way to have an independent check on what they're reading.
Let me ask you a philosophical point here. It seems that everyone who alleges bias is always in turn being charged with bias. As someone who has charged bias, and also someone who's been charged with it himself, do you think there's any way to actually prove it? Or is it just quintessentially subjective?
What I've tried to do on SmarterTimes.com is point to specific problems with specific news articles or editorials and avoid, you know, broad claims about how, you know, there's a left-wing conspiracy that's tilting the news at the New York Times. But I think if you go to SmarterTimes.com and look at the archives and, you know, browse through what now is, you know, a year and a half worth of every morning looking at one or two specific stories and pointing out mistakes, you know, I think a certain pattern emerges.
Well, I can imagine that as you were writing the Smarter Times, you'd say to yourself, now, if I had a paper, I would do it this way. So what can we see in The Sun that's a direct reaction from you to something you hated about The Times?
Well, in The New York Sun, there are New York stories on page one every day. I was disappointed some days to pick up The New York Times and find, you know, there were stories from Washington or from Las Vegas or from Paris or London, but there wasn't a New York news story on the front page.
I remember in one Smarter Times item, you noted that in a New York Times story about shopping meccas, the New York Times made a big deal about Albuquerque and actually didn't make much mention of New York.
That's right. We're going to try on our story about, you know, the beginning of the Christmas shopping season to quote shoppers at Macy's and Bloomingdale's in New York City. And if the Times wants to write about the people who are at the Home Depot in Atlanta or the Marshall Field store in Chicago, that's fine for them.
You know that someone has started a New York Sun watchdog site. Have you read it?
I think I've seen it once or twice.
Is there talk around the office that whoever that guy is must be some sort of a nut job with too much time on his hands?
I think we're flattered that someone would take the time to do that critique. We're a little disappointed that it's not as well done as Smarter Times was.
Do you think you helped the Times to improve?
No.
Ira Stoll, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Ira Stoll is the managing editor of the New York Sun and creator of SmarterTimes.com. Smarter Times is one of a growing number of websites dedicated to criticizing a major periodical. Another is the L.A. Examiner, whose prime target is the L.A. Times. When the Examiner's creators heard of Ira Stoll's rise to the Sun, they began dreaming of, quote, the day when their own wealthy industrialist with an itch to take on the L.A. Times would come calling. Enter former Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon. Bent on starting his own conservative paper, Reardon is hiring the Examiner's founders to help him compete against the L.A. Times. Matt Welsh is co-founder of the L.A. Examiner and self-described co-conspirator in the upcoming L.A. Daily. Matt, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess the New York Sun is your canary in the coal mine. Are you nervously watching the Sun's progress as a forecaster of your own fate?
Kind of. There's a couple of things that are different about their experience. One is that they're in a crowded newspaper market. Here we are absolutely not. There are many newspapers, a lot of small ones that people don't pay attention to. However, the New York Times has the Daily News, it has the New York Post covering New York, and so the Sun has to present itself more as an ideological alternative, and I think that the proposed Reardon paper won't have such a set ideological position. I don't think that you would be able to describe it accurately as conservative, for instance.
Well, isn't a conservative paper exactly what the former mayor wants to have?
Well, you know, people in Los Angeles like Richard Reardon because he's a pragmatist, because he's a problem solver, and because he loves L.A. So I don't think that this is going to be, you know, some thumping right-wing paper. The division here in this city isn't necessarily about liberal-conservative or Republican-Democrat. It's more about smart and dumb.
So you suggest that one of the things that has been missing in, at least in the L.A. Times coverage of L.A., is a real love for the city. What besides that do you think that your new paper would provide?
The Times, like many other monopolist papers in the country, tries to model itself after the New York Times, which is a terrific newspaper, regardless of what Iris Dole says. You know, there's things to criticize about it, but the New York Times is the golden yardstick. But the New York Times has this competition on its flank. When papers who are in a monopolist situation try to mimic them, that means they're spending an enormous amount of resources finding feature stories in Utah and looking everywhere except their own backyard. Frankly, at the end of the day, they just don't cover Los Angeles all that much. And so our paper will be pretty much Los Angeles, and not doing it with very notorious political correctness that you'll find in the L.A. Times.
Let's talk about that issue of political correctness at the L.A. Times. Do you think it's too politically left?
Some people, and maybe some people I'll be working with soon, probably think so. For me, it's really not a case of left or right. It's a case of being unwilling to ask tough questions about what's happening to the city. We have an enormous impact of immigration in this city, but when the Los Angeles Times writes about it, they do it with such gingerness. They're afraid of offending communities. We want to offend every day, not in a bigoted way, of course. Who does? This is not a bigoted town, and there's no reason to do anything but condemn people who do that. But to approach everything with this tentativeness is something that the Times has become notorious for, and I don't think that's something you're ever going to see in our newspaper.
Will the Examiner criticize your own upcoming paper?
I hope so. I hope Reardon, who plans to be the editor-in-chief, by the way, not a publisher, I imagine he'll criticize his own writers in print. I mean, we're not going to hire an ombudsman. We're not going to hire people to sort of stroke their chins and look very seriously at issues. We're going to have an aggressive back and forth inside and outside the newsroom and with our readers.
Okay, Matt, thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, exploding the myths about myth in Star Wars and the magical Alan Greenspan.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. There's an accepted practice among journalists. You do not edit the president. And so for the last year and a half, citizens across America have cringed as they listen to President Bush fumble his way through speeches, stating here that Middle East peace must be avoided, and there that he wants to make the death tax permanent, and many other, in his words, misunderestimations.
In my speech to the nation, whatever you want to call it, speech to the nation. I asked Americans to give 4,000 hours over the rest of your life of service to America.
But inside the White House, the no-edit rule does not apply. Presidential transcripts are sanitized to correct grammatical errors and omit the taunts from jeering crowds. Even White House spokesman Ari Fleischer has had his transcript whitewashed, or so it seems. Dana Milbank chronicles these and other Inside the Beltway curiosities as White House reporter for The Washington Post. He says it seems as if the editing may be accelerating.
They're not really inventing words that he didn't say. They're fixing words. He says the word's wrong. They clean it up. In other cases, they are doing things with asterisks. For example, he said that the United States and Japan have been great allies for a century and a half. He said this to the Japanese Diet, the parliament, and no doubt that caused some scratching of heads. But it was helpfully explained in the transcript with an asterisk that that was half a century. You mentioned that one about making the death tax permanent, that also had an asterisk at the bottom of the page, said, should read death tax repeal, as if that were, say, a transcription error, that we just had read it wrong in the first place.
So you think that tidying the transcripts is really more about clarifying the president's words than it is about cleaning up his image?
Well, that's where the debate is. I believe that the stenos who do this work are professionals who have no particular interest in that. They're hired by the government, but they're not government employees. They're certainly not political employees, and they go from administration to administration. Where it's interesting is, are they being pressured by the political people who work in the White House press office? They do put a lot of pressure on a lot of folks, so it's not inconceivable that they'd be putting pressure on these government contract workers. That strikes me as a minorly intriguing point. Certainly not a major scandal, though.
But there was this infamous incident involving Ari Fleischer. Fleischer said Americans need to watch what they say, and that was omitted from a transcript. Is that a good example of how far they'll go to scrub the record?
In that case, they said it was a mistake that was just dropped for that. I tell you, at the time, I was very much inclined to believe that. I got a little concerned when I saw a few of these happen in 1 week. It's impossible to say for sure whether one thing or another is a mistake or the pressure is being applied to somebody. But in recent weeks and months, it seems that the language has been cleaned up more heavily.
And do you think that is a post-9/11 phenomenon?
Well, all the cases that come to mind have been post-9/11. On the other hand, there has been at least one case recently where they have included the hecklers. And I should point out, in the time since I wrote this article, we've been seeing a lot more very honest transcripts with a lot of ahs and uhs and false starts. Unfortunately, that makes it a lot harder to quote, so perhaps we should have been careful what we wished for.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Dana Milbank is the White House reporter for The Washington Post. And now for a look at the week in Greenspan. The Chicago Tribune: Greenspan opposes raising deposit shield. The New York Times: Greenspan questions some implicit U.S. subsidies. The Toronto Star: Fed chairman sees signs of capital rebound. The Belfast Telegraph: cool it, says Greenspan. I could go on. We all could. Last year, Bob noted that while Greenspan ponders the market, the press ponders him. The more ponderous the market, the more they all ponder. So here's that piece again.
The lengths people go to divine the intentions of Alan Greenspan.
Let's check the briefcase indicator.
No matter how impossible that mission, the financial markets and the media that cover them keep on trying. The daily CNBC program Squawk Box actually examines the thickness of Greenspan's satchel to conclude whether an interest rate change is in the offing.
It does look kind of chubby.
I don't think
so. Come on, let's get a shot of it. We need to see it from the side.
That looks pretty good. Look at the way the line of the leather breaks.
Squawk Box is by no means alone in the effort to interpret every move, every utterance, every non-utterance of the inscrutable Fed chairman for signs of his intentions. Greenspan, he of the owlish expression and opaque public persona, is stalked by the press as if he were the Princess Diana, the JFK Jr., the Marilyn Monroe of monetary policy. Except he isn't dead, no matter what you may have concluded by listening to his congressional testimony.
When confronted with a period of structural change, our policy actions must be based in large part on identifying emerging trends from surprises and anomalies in the data.
When he sits down to discuss monetary policy or the course of interest rates, when he's sitting down in Congress there, nobody knows what he's talking about, and that's on purpose.
Bill Griffiths is host of CNBC's Midday Power Lunch program.
He doesn't say left or right, up or down, north or south. When all is said and done, you still don't know how hot it's going to be tomorrow.
Doesn't matter, though. The great man has spoken. Consider Lisa Singhania. She's an Associated Press reporter in New York who has the unenviable duty in each day's market wrap-up story to synthesize from the billion or 2 billion shares traded what particular news or economic forces moved the market. This exercise is approximately like finding a key phrase to describe the collected works of Aristotle.
It's a lot of educated guesswork, and one of the things you realize very quickly is that nobody knows quite what's going on in the market. But on a day where Alan Greenspan is going to do something, when the Federal Reserve is going to meet, I think it's safe to say that you won't have to worry about your lead for the day.
It's strange to recall that this man was on Gerald Ford's Council of Economic Advisors during the days of 20% inflation and was viewed skeptically by Wall Street 13 and a half years ago as a supposed political animal subject to presidential manipulation. Now he is virtually synonymous with independence, perspicacity, and something approaching papal infallibility. In a story about OPEC oil ministers this week, the New York Times used the phrase, without feeling any need for further explanation, Greenspan-like precision. Furthermore, he's a bona fide celebrity. What do you think of Alan Greenspan?
I heard that if whatever he says, the market follows.
What do you think of Dennis Hastert?
I don't know who that is.
What do you think of Alan Greenspan?
I think he's doing a good job.
How about Vladimir Putin? Any thoughts?
Don't know.
What do you think of Alan Greenspan?
I think he's doing a good job.
With the
market and the situation, yeah.
And what about Justin Timberlake? How do you feel about him?
Who is this?
Lead singer for NSYNC.
Don't know him.
It's hard to believe that any Federal Reserve Board member could be a household name, but thanks in no small part to the media's obsession with him, Greenspan has transcended his carefully cultivated dullness to become a short, balding, somewhat aged matinee idol.
He's at the top of the ziggurat.
Lloyd Grove writes the Reliable Source gossip column for the Washington Post and is himself poised, ever vigilant, on the Greenspan watch. Because, well, duh.
He's the most powerful man in the world. At least that's what I'm saying.
And that means tracking his every after 5 p.m. move. Not that Greenspan swoops through Washington with Henry Kissinger-like flamboyance. He swoops through Washington on the arm of his wife, NBC's Andrea Mitchell, with studied diffidence. He put the reserve in Federal Reserve. He is the center of a worldwide cult of non-personality.
He's not really an ebullient sort of guy. The most fascinating thing I ever heard about him is that when he takes a bath at 5:30 in the morning and thinks the great thoughts about the economy, he adjusts the water temperature by manipulating the taps with his toes.
Yeah. Finding just the right balance, neither too cool nor overheated. The point is, the man is of such mythic stature that the Washington Post is trading in his metatarsal bathwater adjustment behaviors. How weird is that? Well, actually, upon further reflection, it's not weird at all, because Greenspan is no longer merely the steward of economic expansion, nor even the master of economic expansion. Under the ever more bearish circumstances, wherein all hope is invested in one historic figure, he has become the messiah of economic expansion for the investment community and especially for those who cover it. CNBC's Bill Griffiths.
Now he's God. The media need a symbol. We need a catchphrase. We need, you know, something that will personalize a story that we, when all is said and done, don't fully understand. I mean, who understands economics? If you can give it a face, if you give it a personality, you can better explain what this is all about.
So, load up on Greenspan futures. No matter how bad the corporate news, no matter how rapidly we veer toward recession, no matter how thin the man's briefcase is, you don't have to worry about a bear market for Alan Greenspan. Because the media's obsessive fixation on the chairman of the Federal Reserve is not based on what he actually does, nor even on irrational exuberance. It is based at least as much on naked self-interest. And media self-interest, unlike economic expansion, is immutable and forever.
The latest film in the Star Wars franchise, Episode II, Attack of the Clones, opens May 16th, eagerly awaited by fans both highbrow and low. This being public radio, it's the highbrow fans we want to address. You may have been soothed by the notion that Star Wars draws its inspiration from history's great epics, from Virgil and Homer, even from God Almighty. It apparently soothed George Lucas, who quickly adopted the views of Bill Moyers and his confrere, the late mythologist Joseph Campbell, who told us in their PBS series The Power of Myth that Star Wars could be likened to the Bible, as in the scene from the first film where Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, Chewbacca, and Princess Leia fall into a trash compactor.
Got a bad feeling about this. The wall!
Don't just stand there! Try and brace it with something!
But my favorite scene was when they were in the garbage compactor and the walls were closing in, and I thought, that's like the belly of the whale that Joe
that's
Campbell...
That's what it is. Yeah, that's where they were. Yeah, they're down in the belly of the whale.
What's the mythological significance of the belly?
It's the descent into the dark. Jonah in the whale. I mean, that's a standard motif of going into the whale's belly and coming out again.
But Stephen Hart, writing in a recent issue of Salon.com, isn't buying it. He says fans seeking cultural cover for their guilty pleasure were gulled by Moyers and Campbell. Sometimes he says, a trash compactor is just a trash compactor.
Now, this is supposed to represent the belly of the whale in which the hero is transformed, except no transformation does occur. They get their help from an outside agency, C-3PO. They emerge pretty much the same. Luke Skywalker does not call upon the Force to hold back the crushing walls of the compactor. There's no transformation to speak of in story terms or character terms.
So your premise here is that George Lucas says that he used Joseph Campbell's work, but actually he didn't.
The connections to literary science fiction, classic science fiction, are just screamingly obvious, whereas any connections with mythology and religious imagery are so vague and amorphous as to be virtually useless.
First of all, the screamingly obvious antecedents to Star Wars. Give me a few of those.
The Foundation series, written by Isaac Asimov. The Lensman series, written by E.E. Doc Smith.
That one features both a Force and something that could stand in easily for lightsabers.
It features several parallels to the Star Wars series. The Lensmen speak of what they call the cosmic all, whereas in Star Wars, of course, you have the Force. We've learned from The Phantom Menace that the Jedi get their powers from little microscopic entities called midichlorians. The Lensmen get their powers from collections of microscopic entities called lenses.
Well, if, as you claim, George Lucas borrowed actually very little from Joseph Campbell, then why is Joseph Campbell so quick to celebrate and publicize the association?
Certainly it didn't hurt his bottom line to have his writings associated with a hugely successful movie series. It was a mutually beneficial association both for Campbell and George Lucas. It certainly added a bit of gravitas to the Star Wars movies. It's very classy to be able to cite Joseph Campbell as an influence as opposed to Isaac Asimov and E.E. Doc Smith.
I wonder, do you dismiss the notion that some science fiction actually can be profound?
No, wouldn't dismiss it at all. One of the complaints I would have with Star Wars, in fact, is that it helps cement the image of science fiction as something that it actually outgrew about 70 years ago. Film science fiction is pretty much 70 years behind literary science fiction.
Given how absolutely fanatic, hardcore science fiction fans can be, why wasn't there somebody else shaking their fists over this obvious ripoff?
To a lot of science fiction fans, the things that I wrote in the article are too obvious to even go into. Why some of the writers didn't go after George Lucas, I don't know. Isaac Asimov was a gentle soul. Some writers are very militant. I know Harlan Ellison has become famous for going after people who rip off his ideas. He got a settlement from James Cameron for the movie The Terminator.
This whole thing really makes you angry, the fact that George Lucas and Joseph Campbell are feeding off of each other and that they've given cultural cover to all Star Wars fans. Is there something about this beyond this story that makes you angry?
What irritates me is the thought of a whole generation of science fiction writers whose work has been plundered by Hollywood, going unnoticed yet again, adding insult to injury. The Rolling Stones took their name from a Muddy Waters song. Imagine if they turned around and said they'd never heard of Muddy Waters and they got all their inspiration from Beethoven. We're talking about that level of absurdity here. I would think it a matter of grace and integrity for George Lucas to acknowledge his sources. I'm saying let's put away the togas and put the chariots up on blocks and send the spear carriers home. We don't have to go to ancient Greece to find the sources of Star Wars. You just have to go to a used bookstore that traffics in science fiction magazines of the 1950s, and you'll find all the parallels there that you need.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Stephen Hart wrote the recent Salon article, Galactic Gas Bag.
Or as it was originally known, may the fraud be with you.
Thanks again.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis and Michael Cavanaugh, engineered by Scott Strickland, Dylan Keefe, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Lou Olkowski. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I am your father.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.